Hi, everyone, and welcome to Outlook Live, the Federal Reserve System's audio conference series on consumer compliance hot topics. My name is Tracy Bassinger, and I am with the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. I want to start by thanking everyone for your patience today. As many of you have noticed, we are experiencing some technical difficulties with our server. We are doing our best to get those corrected, but we wanted to go ahead and start with the presentation. So if you have downloaded copies of the slides ahead of time, that's probably going to be your best bet right now. We're going to go ahead and announce which slide we're speaking to and go ahead and give the presentation and make sure that when we post it on our website afterwards that we link the slide advancement with the audio portion as well. There's also the audio conference bridge that's available to folks if you're having trouble getting onto the website. So with that out of the way, I'll go ahead and jump right into what we're going to be covering today. So today's webinar is on consumer compliance hot topics. And we are lucky to have a panel of speakers that I believe can speak to a wide range of consumer protection rules and regulatory guidance that in this rapidly changing world of consumer protection. I'll begin by turning things over to Jason Liu, who is the Compliance Risk Coordinator for the San Francisco Fed. Following Jason's presentation will be remarks by Ken Benton, a Senior Consumer Regulation Specialist at the Philadelphia Fed, and then Cecilia Knowles, a Senior Manager here at the San Francisco Fed, will be our final presenter. Before I hand things over to our presenters, I want to say just a couple more logistical remarks. The presentation, as I mentioned, is available for downloading on our website on consumercomplianceoutlook.org, so if it's available to you to do that, you might want to do that during the presentation if you haven't already. In conjunction with these webinars, the Federal Reserve also publishes a quarterly newsletter entitled Consumer Compliance Outlook, which is also available at the Consumer Compliance Outlook website. And if you subscribe to the Outlook newsletter electronically, you are automatically notified of future Outlook Live webinars and also receive notification when a new issue of the newsletter is released. Both programs are part of the Federal Reserve System's outreach activities and are delivered free of charge. And as I mentioned, the webcast and audio feeds from today are going to be archived and available for later playback on our website. Today we plan to go about 45 minutes with our presentation, leaving us about 15 minutes for a question and answer session. Given our late start, we may go a few minutes over the scheduled hour today if we have questions pending in our queue. And we have received a number of questions prior to today's presentation. If you are able to get into the online part of the presentation, there's a chat feature there that you can use to submit questions. Otherwise, you can submit them to the email box that was part of your registration. We'll do our best to cover as many of the questions as we can today, but please understand that we can't always get to all of them. And that will wrap up my introductory remarks. And with that, Jason, I'll turn things over to you.
Thanks, Tracy. As Tracy mentioned, we're having trouble with the slide, so I'll try my best to reference the slide that I'm on. But moving into the presentation, because of the sheer number of new and proposed rules, as well as some pretty significant changes to the regulatory environment, we thought it would be useful to conduct a year-end webinar to recap 2011 and highlight the changes that are still in process. As you can see from the agenda, we'll also cover some areas in a little more detail, specifically focusing on the mortgage lending rules, UDAP, and a handful of miscellaneous topics we thought might be of interest. On slide three, the most significant change for 2011 was the creation of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which opened for business on July 21st of this year. This slide highlights some of the Bureau's core functions. Among its responsibilities is rulemaking. The Bureau was granted rule-writing authority for the federal consumer financial laws. The term is defined in the Dodd-Frank Act and includes the 18 enumerated laws and regulations and the provisions of Title 10. The Bureau also has supervision authority over large banks, saving associations, and credit unions with greater than $10 billion in assets. To avoid confusion, the agencies clarified that the asset size determination is based on the criteria used for deposit insurance assessment purposes. For those institutions at about the $10 billion mark, the initial determination was made using June 30th, 2011 numbers. Any future changes in supervisor will be based on four consecutive quarters of data. Under its non-bank supervision authority, the Bureau has authority to supervise any company in the mortgage, payday lending, and private lending markets. For those other markets, the Bureau will generally only be able to supervise larger market participants. The Bureau has requested comment on how best to define who is considered a larger participant and is required to issue final rules by July 21st, 2012. Moving on to slide four, we're often asked which regulations the Bureau will examine. So we put together a list on slide four to help illustrate the rules the Bureau is responsible for enforcing. This applies generally to institutions with over $10 billion in assets. As you look through this list, you'll notice that this list doesn't include a lot of the rules that are typically covered in the consumer compliance examination. On slide five, I listed the rules that will remain with the prudential regulator. So to clarify, if you're an institution with over $10 billion in assets, the Bureau will supervise and enforce the rules listed on slide four, and the prudential regulator or your prudential regulator will supervise and enforce the rules listed on slide five. If your institution is less than $10 billion in assets, you will continue to be supervised by your current regulator. One other thing I'll point out, the regulatory citations listed on this page are specific to the Federal Reserve. Since a number of the rules, specifically FLOOD, CRA, Regulation G, and parts of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, are implemented by individual regulatory agencies, the citations will differ depending on which agency's rules you reference. The content will be the same, but the naming conventions will be different. The next two slides, slides six and seven, include a lot of data. The table lists the rules that have changed over the past year and the pending rules that remain in process. I'm not going to walk through these slides in detail, but I included them to highlight the volume of changes that have occurred. The table is organized by product, so hopefully it will be a helpful tool for your institution to use in verifying that you've appropriately considered all the recent and future regulatory changes. I'd also like to refer you to the regulatory calendar available on the Consumer Compliance Outlook website. The calendar is embedded with links to the rules, and they reference any articles or webinars that we've conducted. A couple things I'd point out. The table doesn't include regulator-specific guidance, so the FDIC overdraft guidance as well as the OCC's proposed guidance on deposit-related credit products aren't included. I'd encourage you to reference your primary regulator and the CFPB's website for additional guidance. Also, you'll notice that mortgages are the most heavily impacted product. So if you engage in mortgage lending activity, it's important to ensure that you've taken into consideration all of the changes that have occurred. Moving to slide eight, in addition to the final and proposed rules listed on slides six and seven, slide eight lists some of the areas, the Dodd-Frank Act, where we can expect more Dodd-Frank Act rules to be implemented. Specifically, the Bureau will have authority to supervise non-bank entities that are considered larger participants. As I mentioned earlier, the Bureau issued a notice and request for comment to seek input on how to define larger participants. The Dodd-Frank Act also requires the Bureau to combine the Truth in Lending Act and RESPA disclosures. As part of this process, the Bureau launched its Know Before You Know initiative, a process in which the Bureau solicits comments on prototype disclosures. The Bureau has gone through a number of versions of its mortgage disclosures and has recently launched a prototype credit card agreement. If you offer these products, I would encourage you to look at the prototypes and provide feedback to help inform the regulatory process. The Dodd-Frank Act also includes a number of mortgage-related provisions. Proposed rules have yet to be issued, but we thought it'd be useful to list the areas where we may see additional changes. I'm moving on to slide nine. I've included a lot of information up until now, so I'm going to shift gears and talk about some of the resources available through the Consumer Compliance Outlook website. In addition to the Outlook Live webinars, which are archived and available for later viewing, the Federal Reserve System also publishes the Consumer Compliance Outlook newsletter. It's a quarterly newsletter that focuses on consumer compliance topics. I've included the topics from the newsletters for the past year on slides 9 and 10 to give you an idea of the information that is covered. I mentioned the regulatory calendar earlier, but the newsletter also includes a section covering news from Washington that provides a regulatory update of events during the quarter. The newsletter also contains a section covering recent court rulings titled On the Docket, where court rulings and their implications are summarized. On slide 11, I've listed all of the Outlook Live events that we've conducted. And as I mentioned earlier, these events are recorded and are available for playback. I'd encourage you to go back and listen to any of the previous events that might be of interest. With that, Ken, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Jason. I'm going to be covering in slides 12 and 13 eight new mortgage rules, five of which became effective in 2011, three of which were issued as per rulemaking proposals and are not yet final. The five final rules are listed on slide 12, and I'm going to provide a high-level overview of these few five rules. Starting on slide 13 is the Mortgage Transfer Notice Rule 22639 of Regulation Z. Congress, in the Helping Families Save Their Home Act, required that when title to a mortgage is transferred, signed, or sold to someone else, the person acquiring the mortgage must provide notice to the borrower. During the financial crisis, there was some anecdotal evidence that borrowers were trying to modify their mortgage and couldn't determine who was the owner. This law is designed to address that issue. When a transfer does occur, the person purchasing the mortgage, acquiring title to it, must provide notice within 30 days. However, there is an exception that if the transfer occurs for a period of less than 30 days, no notice is required. There has been a similar requirement under RESPA Regulation X that when the servicing rights for a mortgage change, the person who gets the new servicing rights must notify the borrower. This is different. This rule applies to the creditor who owns the mortgage, not the servicing rights. Because sometimes there's overlap between a change in the servicing rights and a change in the ownership of the mortgage, the official staff commentary in Section 39 says it is permissible to consolidate the notices into one form to notify the borrower of the change in the servicing rights as well as the change in the ownership of the mortgage. Next on slide 14 are the new valuation independence rules. You'll notice that we refer to valuation independence, not appraisal independence. The board's final rule says that in some jurisdiction, it's only limited to licensed appraisers, and the board wanted to make the point that this rule is broader than just licensed appraisers. It applies to anyone who's been retained to value a home in connection with a consumer-secured credit transaction. First off, the rule prohibits coercion or other similar actions designed to cause persons performing property valuations to base appraised values on properties on factors other than the independent judgment of the person who's been retained to perform the valuation. Secondly, the rule has a prohibition on conflicts of interest. The person performing the valuation can't have an interest in the property or the loan transaction. In addition, some financial institutions perform valuation functions in-house, so there's a potential conflict because they're funding the loan and the same institution is also conducting the valuation. The board's final rule provides a safe harbor, and if the terms of the safe harbor are complied with, there won't be a violation of the conflicts rules when the financial institution conducts the valuation in-house. Because the requirements of smaller institutions can be different from the ones for larger institutions, the safe harbor is broken into two components, two different ways. One safe harbor for institutions with assets of $250 million or less, another safe harbor for institutions with assets of $250 million or greater. If a creditor determines that there's been a violation of the conflicts or coercion rules, the creditor is required to notify, the creditor is prohibited from proceeding with the transaction unless the creditor determines, after acting with due diligence, that the violation does not materially misrepresent or misstate the value of the consumer's dwelling. In addition, if the creditor finds a violation, it's required to notify the appropriate state licensing authorities for the person conducting the valuation. Finally, the final rule requires that compensation be reasonable and customary. This is designed to ensure that a creditor is not paying excessive compensation in an attempt to influence the valuation. The final rule provides a safe harbor. If complied with, then the reasonable and customary compensation requirement is satisfied. Next up on slide 15 is the final rule for escrow for jumbo loans. In 2008, the board issued a final rule under Regulation Z, creating a new category of consumer protections for what's known as higher price mortgage loans. If a mortgage meets the definition of higher price mortgage loans, then the additional consumer protections apply. The trigger for a higher priced mortgage loan is a loan whose APR exceeds the average prime offer rate for Freddie Mac loans by 1.5 points for a first lien loan and 3.5 points for a subordinate lien loan. One of the protections in the board's final rule is a mandatory escrow for higher priced mortgage loans, first lien higher priced mortgage loans. Congress in the Dodd-Frank Act directed the board to change the trigger for jumbo loans. And that's what that final rule accomplishes. The trigger now for a mandatory escrow for a higher priced mortgage loan that's a jumbo is now 2.5 points instead of 1.5 points. As noted in bullet 3 of slide 15, all other HPML protections for jumbo loans are the same triggers. It's only the escrow trigger that will change. We've provided an example in bullet 4 to facilitate compliance. Next up on slide 16 is the board's loan originator compensation rules, which contains three requirements. First, the loan originator compensation cannot be based on a term or condition of the loan, such as the interest rate. Importantly, this restriction applies not only to the terms and conditions of the loan, but also to a proxy for the loan. The official debt commentary provides, as an example, a credit score, which is not a term or condition, but is considered to be a proxy for the interest rate because creditors vary the interest rate they charge borrowers based on the credit score. You can find more information on the proxy requirements in the official staff commentary for 226.36D. The second requirement of the LOC rules is that if the consumer is paying the loan originator's compensation, no other person can pay any compensation to the originator. Conversely, if the creditor or someone else is paying the originator's compensation, the consumer can't pay anything. In other words, it has to be a single source rule. The final restriction of the rule is an anti-steering prohibition. It provides that an originator of a mortgage loan cannot steer a consumer to a loan to increase his compensation unless the originator can demonstrate that the loan with the higher compensation is in the consumer's best interest. The official staff commentary provides an example in which the loan with the higher compensation has less restrictive prepayment penalties or no prepayment penalties, which might benefit the borrower. So I would encourage you to review that for further information. In addition, the regulation and commentary contain a safe harbor. If the originator follows certain steps in showing the borrower certain features of the loan, he can be in compliance with the anti-steering prohibition. One important point that I've listed in bullet number 4 is with respect to yield spread premiums. I was at a presentation and someone said YSP RIP, and that's not entirely true. Yield spread premiums are prohibited when used to compensate a loan originator. That is, if you say to the originator, I'll provide one rate, one form of compensation if you secure the borrower with one rate and higher compensation if you get the borrower in with a higher rate. That's prohibited. However, in some circumstances, creditors offer to borrowers to provide funding for loan closing costs if the borrower agrees to accept a higher interest rate. As discussed in comment 36D14, that is still permissible. In that case, the loan originator's compensation is not bearing with the loan terms. Finally of note, the Dodd-Frank Act contains its own loan originator compensation rules, most of which are similar to the board's rules. However, the Dodd-Frank Act in Section 1403 contains several anti-steering prohibitions that do not appear in the board's rule. Dodd-Frank Act directs the CFPB to issue implementing regulations, so we can expect in the future that the loan originator compensation rules will have some additional changes when the Bureau issues its final rules. Next up on slide 17 is the SAFE Act registration final rule. The SAFE Act requires that anyone who originates consumer credit transactions secured by a dwelling must register with the Nationwide Mortgage Licensing System and Registry. There was one set of rules for non-depository institutions and another set of rules for loan originators who work for the regulated depository institutions. for the DIs, there was a final rule requiring that employees who originate mortgage loans must register by July 29, 2011, or they're prohibited from originating loans. Therefore, anyone who works in your institution originating loans should have been registered by July 29. Next up on slide 18, I'm going to be discussing three rules that were proposed in 2011 that have not yet become final. These rules were all issued under the Dodd-Frank Act. First, the Dodd-Frank Act directed the board to issue a rule implementing its ability to repay requirement and to place limitations on prepayment penalties. That rule came out earlier this year. Because rulemaking authority for Truth in Lending Act was transferred to the Bureau in July 2011, the final rule will come from the Bureau. Outlook Live did a webinar earlier this year with Maureen Daff, an attorney at the Board of Governors, did an excellent presentation. If you go to our website, you can get more details on the proposal. The second rule that came out is with respect to escrows. I mentioned earlier that the Board's 2008 final rule mandatory escrow for all first lien higher priced mortgage loans. Under the board's 2008 rule, the escrow had to be for a minimum period of 1 year, after which the creditor and consumer could agree to drop the escrow. Congress and Dodd-Frank directed the board to extend the mandatory escrow for higher priced mortgage loans from 1 year to five. The board earlier this year issued that rulemaking proposal, though it's not yet final. In addition, Dodd-Frank Act told the board to make an exemption for creditors primarily operating in rural and underserved areas. The board's rulemaking proposal implemented that requirement. Finally, Dodd-Frank has a qualified residential mortgage requirement. This is also known as the skin in the game, that people who securitize mortgages must retain 5% of the mortgages they securitize. The purpose of this rule is to align the interest of the securitizers with the interest of the investors who buy the securities. However, Dodd-Frank recognized that there may be some instances in which the 5% skin in the game requirement is not necessary for certain safe products. So there's a carve-out in Dodd-Frank Act for what's known as qualified residential mortgage. The DFA directed six agencies to do a rulemaking fleshing out the meaning of a QRM. That rulemaking came out for proposal in March of this year. The comment period was extended. We're now waiting for the final rule. One important point about the QRM rulemaking to note is that the skin in the game requirements in Dodd-Frank do not apply to FHA loans and to any Freddie and Mac and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac loans while Freddie and Fannie are in conservatorship. With that, I'd like to turn to the next topic of our presentation, UDAP. Some people say UDAP because it's gone from UDAP to UDAAP. Abusive is one of the new terms in this UDAP, and that's defined in Section 1031 of Dodd-Frank. We've listed on slide 19 the statutory definition. We would also direct your attention, the Bureau recently published its Supervision and Examination Manual, and we've provided a link to it on one of the slides. It's a PDF with bookmarks, and there's a detailed discussion in the manual about how the Bureau will be implementing the prohibition against unfair, deceptive, or abusive acts or practices. On the next slide, on slide 20, we have listed from the Bureau's manual the legal definition of what an unfair practice is and the legal definition of a deceptive practice. But also point out, in the Bureau's manual, there's a detailed description of unfair and deceptive. It also provides example of prior enforcement actions from federal agencies to give you some sense of what an unfair or deceptive practice can be. Next up on slide 21, UDAP rulemaking. The Dodd-Frank Act in Section 1031 authorizes the Bureau to define by regulation unfair, deceptive, or abusive acts or practices. Section 1022 of Dodd-Frank describes the Bureau's rulemaking requirements, and this applies not just to the UDAP rulemaking, but to any regulation issued by the Bureau. We've listed those requirements in bullets 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. The Bureau must consult with prudential regulators. the Bureau must conduct a cost-benefit analysis to determine whether the rulemaking it's considering issuing will affect the availability of consumer financial products and services. The Bureau must consider the impact on community banks and persons in rural areas. And importantly, to inform its rulemaking function and to make the Bureau more proactive, the Dodd-Frank Act requires that the Bureau must establish a surveillance system to monitor risks to consumers. And the idea is it's a sort of an early warning system. If the Bureau sees that there is a practice that poses a risk of harm to consumers, it can undertake a rulemaking to address that practice. Finally, the Bureau is authorized under Dodd-Frank to exempt any class of persons or financial products or services. Next up, on slide 22, I mentioned we provided the link, the PDF link to the Bureau's examination manual. There's a screen capture there of a section of the manual, just to give you some sense of what it contains. In addition, our Consumer Compliance Outlook website, if you go to the main site, there's a link there for resources, and we have a list of resources to help better understand the requirements for unfair, deceptive, or abusive acts or practices. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Cecilia.
Thanks, Ken. Now on to slide number 23. Before I address the impact on the consumer, I would first like to say what the impact of UDAP has had on the banking industry as a whole. It's been said that UDAP reflects the fundamental shift from what we knew as consumer compliance and what we're learning today to be consumer protection. Regulators are equally assessing technical compliance with regulatory requirements, such as are disclosures accurate, are they given timely, as well as issues related to fairness. Was the consumer provided with all the information necessary to make an informed decision? So given this, today's compliance management programs need to ensure that the institution is not only disclosure compliant, but also that products, services, marketing, communication channels are free of terms or conditions that are unfair, deceptive, or abusive. In other words, and as often said, is it fair as well as disclosure compliant? It's also important that consumer issues related to fairness and deception be considered at all stages of the product of the life cycle. From product development to delivery to servicing, a cradle-to-grave concept. The issues stemming from the recent foreclosure crisis have taught us that the issue can arise at any stage of the product life cycle. One important thing to remember is, though, although we have listed resources that are currently available to help in your UDAP self-assessment, please understand that UDAP compliance is regularly being shaped by both the courts as well as regulatory expectation and enforcement actions. With the number of lawsuits and regulatory actions related to overdraft protection products, a key example here. As such, it's important to receive industry publications such as our own Consumer Compliance Outlook publication to help stay up to date on current legal cases, settlements, and enforcement actions, and to help understand how issues related to unfairness and deceptions are continually being defined. The guidance we've listed on this slide incorporates some of the things to consider when evaluating UDAP risk, but not intended to be the end-all and be-all list. Having said that, though, consumer complaint data can be a goldmine in assessing whether or not your organization may have any potential UDAP issues. It is not uncommon for regulatory actions related to UDAP to have started with a seemingly simple consumer complaint. We can't encourage you enough to ensure your complaint process is robust and then to review and analyze data from your complaints to see if there's any potential broader issues that may arise due to and be a UDAP level. In conducting your internal analysis, we suggest that you ask yourself, does this issue pass the smell test? Also sometimes mentioned, would you give this product or service to your mother or someone that you care about? Did the consumer receive all the information necessary on a timely basis so that they can make an informed decision? Is there anything about the product structure, its terms or conditions, that does not result in reasonable options for that consumer? If you're asking yourself these questions and considering them in your compliance analysis and reviews, you should be better suited to be able to position your UDAP position and respond to any questions and to provide a good response when it comes to questions about whether something is UDAP compliant. Moving on to slide number 24 and a discussion on some changes to deposit-related items. First off, I want to discuss the repeal of Regulation Q. Effective July 21st, 2011, banks can now pay interest on DDA accounts. Given these changes, it's important to remember that the FDIC for interest-bearing accounts is $250,000, while it's unlimited FDIC insurance on non-interest-bearing until year-end 2012. A question's already come up regarding this slide stating and correcting that the repeal of Regulation Q does now allow for interest to be paid on DDA accounts, but does not affect the restrictions on now account eligibility. So I wanted to bring that up. That is with Regulation D. And moving on to Regulation CC, as we all know, in 2011, next day availability was changed from $100 to $200. What's important to remember in 2012 is that there are proposed amendments that are still being considered that may address or are addressing the clearing and returning of checks electronically, adding provisions that govern electronic items cleared through the check collection system, and with these changes would support the shortening of the exception hold to 4 business days. Now on to slide 25 and discuss the changes to lending-related items, with specifically being interagency FLED Q&As. By way of background, when the interagency published the FLED Q&As on July 21, 2009, there were 5 questions and answers proposed. On October 14, 2011 of this year, the FFIEC finalized 2 of these Q&As, withdrew 1, and have asked for additional comments on 3 Q&As that have had significant and substantive changes made to them. Let's start first with the 2 final and the 1 withdrawn Q&A. Question 9, it clarifies the term insurable value. Before, on question 9, insurable value was solely restricted to the FEMA guideline that stated that insurable value had to equal replacement cost value in all cases. The new Q&A recognizes that this was too restrictive and at times resulted when borrowers pay for more coverage than the NFIP would pay in the event of a loss. So the new Q&A sets out to provide examples and flexibility in establishing the insurable value. For instance, the new Q&A provides the possibility of using replacement cost value established for hazard insurance, as well as a cost value appraisal can be used. Please note that a cost value appraisal is different than a market value appraisal, which is so often used in single-family residence valuations. Question 10 was the question that was withdrawn and was as a result of the alternative approaches suggested in question 9, which eliminated the need for question 10. And the third final question is question 61, which addresses the forced placement of insurance and when lenders should force place insurance after the 45-day notice period ends. The expectation is still is to force place as soon as possible after the 45-day period ends. But this Q&A allows some exceptions to this rule. However, this must be provided with a reasonable explanation for any of these delays. Now onto the 3 proposed Q&As. All 3 also have to do with forced placement of insurance. Question 60 addresses how soon can the 45-day notice be provided to the borrower. This proposed Q&A is trying to reconcile the statute requirements of the Act that notification can only be provided when the insurance policy expires or considered less than the amount required, and also trying to allow for continuous coverage. However, given the inflexibility of the statute requirement, this proposed Q&A still restricts when the notification can be provided, or proposes it still restrict when the notification can be provided, but does state that the lender can advise and clearly advise the borrower when insurance is about to expire. Question 62 addresses whether a borrower may be charged for the cost of flood insurance during the 45 forced placement notification period. This proposal allows for this if the borrower has given express authority to the lender to charge for such coverage as a contractual condition at the time the loan was made. And then finally, the third proposed Q&A is question 57. This was a previously finalized question and has to do with communication with borrowers regarding forced placement of flood insurance. However, given the proposed changes to questions 60 and 62, this question also is requiring revisions and is seeking comment on the proposal. Finally, and now on to slide 26, and this is to discuss some changes that are upcoming in 2012 for the CRA, the Community Reinvestment Act. Beginning in January 2012, HMDA and CRA data collection and reporting needs to be based on the 2010 census data. The FFIEC geocoding system will be updated in January 2012 to provide information based on this updated census track listing. Given this, though, please remember if your bank does not use the FFIEC geocoding database, you'll want to verify that your third-party vendor has updated their database to reflect these changes. Other changes that are coming in 2012 is, beginning in 2012, is the FFIEC will now be publishing the median family income. It currently is being published by the Department of Housing and Urban Development. The median family income will be calculated annually for the metropolitan and non-metropolitan areas. In addition, the U.S. Census Bureau will now be conducting surveys that provides data every year through what is called the American Community Survey. This ongoing survey provides data every year that is designed to provide local communities with reliable and timely demographic, social, and housing data each year. The FFIEC will now start to use this 2010 American Community Survey five-year estimated data to create a new database of tract income, race, ethnicity, and other demographic characteristics. This information will be updated every 5 years. What's important to note here is that examiners will be using this updated information when conducting compliance and CRA exams beginning in 2012, so banks should also ensure that they are using the updated tools as well. This concludes our proposed remarks, and now we move to the Q&A part of the presentation. At this point, Tracy, I will hand this over to you.
Okay, thanks, Cecilia. Before I jump right into the Q&A, I just want to make sure, I think a number of you have probably noticed this, but the website is back and up and operational and the online chat feature is working, so if you are on the phone and you haven't switched over and would like to do that, things seem to be working well right now. So let me jump into the questions. We've received quite a few of them, and I'll start with you, Jason. The first question I'm going to throw out at you is, you used the term or referred to prudential regulator in your remarks, and can you please define for our audience what that means?
Okay, great. So the term prudential regulator basically refers to an institution's primary regulator, and I think it's best illustrated with an example. So, for instance, if your institution is a state member bank, your primary regulator would be one of the reserve banks. For institutions with more than $10 billion in assets, part of those consumer rules will be transferred to the Bureau for them to supervise. So for that institution, you're supervised by the CFPB, but your prudential regulator would be the Federal Reserve Bank. Hope that answers the question. Tracy, turn it back to you.
Okay, Jason, one more for you before we move on to a couple for Ken. The Dodd-Frank Act mandates collection of expanded HMDA data and requires collection of additional data on small business loans. When do those rules become effective?
Great question. The Dodd-Frank Act does mandate changes to Regulation C, specifically to expand the HMDA data fields, and also requires expansion of Reg B for collection of data for small business loans. But both of those would require rules to be written by the Bureau. So at this point, there's no effective date since rules have not yet even been proposed. What I would reference you to is the Outlook Live event that we held late last year on HMDA and CRA data collection. It walks through those Dodd-Frank Act requirements in a lot of detail and also provides an example of when final rules are issued, how that would be implemented.
Okay, thanks, Jason. Ken, now I have a couple for you. First one is, when will the changes to mortgage regulation in Title 14 of the Dodd-Frank Act become effective?
Okay, Tracy, that's a great question. Dodd-Frank contains 16 titles, two of which primarily affect consumer protection. Title 10 creates the Bureau. Title 14 contains significant mortgage reform. Dodd-Frank specifies that the final date by which all of the provisions of Title 14 must become effective is no later than 1 year after the Bureau issues final implementing regulations. And Title 14 directs the Bureau to do that no later than January 21st, 2013. So the absolute final date for regulations, all the regulations under Title 14 to be promulgated and become effective is January 21st, 2014. However, Dodd-Frank also provides that if the Bureau fails to issue the implementing regulations by July 21st, 2013, then all the requirements in Title 14 become effective on that date, January 21st, 2013. Finally, another possible scenario is that the Bureau could issue the rules sooner than those dates. Those are only the absolute final deadlines. It doesn't prohibit the Bureau from issuing them sooner.
Okay, thanks, Ken. And our second question here is a little bit longer, so I'm going to read through what we have, and you can give it a shot. And it has to do with the SAFE Act. And the question says, Bank A is in the process of registering its MLOs. The bank did not register by the July deadline. The bank has two MLOs from December of 2010 to December of 2015, and they have originated a total of nine 1-4 family loans. Is Bank A, and the bank has originated, with the two different MLOs have originated different numbers of loans. Is the bank in violation because it did not register by the deadline or because each MLO originated five or fewer loans in the 12-month period? Does it qualify as a de minimis exception?
The SAFE Act contains a de minimis exception that says if a mortgage loan originator originates five or fewer mortgage loans within a 12-month period, then the SAFE Act requirements do not apply.
Okay.
Tracy, there is a caveat about circumventing the SAFE Act requirements through the de minimis exception. So you have to be careful that it's just an instance in which you have someone who only does five or fewer rather than trying to structure it to avoid the requirements of the SAFE Act.
Great. Thank you. Now, Cecilia, I have a couple for you. It looks like we've our audience has identified a technical error we have on our slide with regard to NOW accounts. We're getting a lot of questions, so I'll let you go ahead and try and clarify our point there.
Okay. First, I apologize for that error. It's correct that some of the audience is stating that Reg D hasn't been repealed and the NOW account eligibility hasn't changed at this point. However, what has happened with the repeal of Regulation Q is that interest can now be made on interest, demand deposit interest. Interest can be paid on demand accounts. So it's correct that there is still the NOW account eligibility requirement. One of the questions was, when do we see that maybe changes would be made to Reg D? At this point, I haven't heard anything, so I can't answer that.
Okay. So we're also getting a number of questions with regard to your comments on UDAP and this whole issue of suitability and whether there's any requirement that institutions conduct any sort of suitability analysis or take that into consideration in the offering of their products and services. So maybe you can address that for us.
Okay. Thank you, and that's a really good question. There's a lot of discussion about that right now. The short answer is no, is that we're not requiring and we will not be examining for any suitability with any of the products or services. Suitability is making the news most often as part of more public policy discussions, and it really goes in line with how far is the paradigm shift going between consumer compliance and consumer protection. In the early 2011 when a lot of discussion was having about mortgage products and whether or not that it should be required that only plain vanilla mortgages could be offered, and then a lot of the suitability discussions were held at that point. But understanding, and it's very, when working through the UDAP issues and concerns you have at the bank, please don't confuse suitability with assessing reasonability when selling or marketing products, is that you still have to understand the audience and the client base that you are selling products to, and they have to reasonably be provided with enough information that they can make an informed decision, but this is not a suitability type of examination or review.
Okay. Great. And Jason, this one was directed at you, but it also relates to UDAP. I think you're getting it because it has to do with guidance. And is there any other regulatory guidance out there with regard to UDAP that would help clarify how we should be considering whether something is unfair or deceptive?
Great question. Cecilia's slide includes quite a few questions that that you should be asking as you look at your products and services. And one of the themes, and I'm not just generally to consider, is looking at those products and services over the life lifeline of that product. In terms of resources and guidance, the agency started issuing guidance back in 2001, so depending on your regulator, you'd be best to reference some of those pieces of guidance. Specific to the FDIC and the Federal Reserve, interagency guidance was issued back in 2004, and that document goes into not only the statutory definition, but it also provides some guidance on standards for how we would look, basically apply those standards to the rules. That document also includes some best practices on how we would look at, for example, marketing that's done by the bank, how we would look at disclosures and so on and so forth. So would refer you to those pieces of guidance. Also, there's a lot of articles out there in the public arena published by a lot of the industry trade groups. So there's definitely a lot of information out there, and would encourage you to look up some of that information as well.
Great. Okay, our next question has to do with flood. So, Cecilia, I'm going to address that one to you. Do your comments on flood mean that the bank must get formal acknowledgement from the borrower to charge for the flood insurance in the interim? And if so, what is considered acceptable acknowledgement from the borrower?
I take this as meaning that can they charge for the insurance during the 45-day notification period. And the proposal as it's written right now and put out is it says that you have to actually have acknowledgement at the time of the contractual agreement is made with that loan. So I don't know that it's providing any flexibility to be able to have the borrower sign off on anything to be able to put and have them charge them for that insurance during the 45-day period at this point.
Okay, switching back to you, Ken. Question on slide 21, asking if you can please explain the last bullet point on that particular slide and repeat your comments there.
Sure, Tracy. This is just a general a power of the Bureau. It issues a regulation, and it determines that there is a particular financial product or service that it doesn't want the regulation to apply to. So the Bureau could say in the rulemaking, we are requiring this or we are prohibiting this, except that these requirements or these prohibitions do not apply to whatever the Bureau determines that it does, it wants to exempt. And then the Bureau would explain the reason why it might exempt that class of person or financial products or service. So it's just to give the Bureau additional authority if it determines that there's a good justification for carving out a particular class of persons or products or services that are otherwise subject to the regulation.
Great, thank you. And Ken, I understand that we've gotten a lot of questions on the mortgage loan originator compensation, and you have some comments you'd like to make about those.
Yeah, okay. I first want to circle back to my one of my slides. I said that you can't vary with the loan terms or condition. I didn't meant to. There is one important exception for the loan amount. Mortgage loan originators can vary compensation based on the loan amount. That is, they get a higher amount based on a higher loan amount. That is an important exception. Secondly, I wanted to just reference back, Outlook Live did a two-hour webinar earlier this year. Nikki Pastor and Paul Monder, two senior attorneys at the Board of Governors, did an elaborate presentation on the mortgage loan originator compensation rules. And I'd like to encourage anyone with questions to go to the Outlook Live website, and you can replay the webinar, the audio, and the presentation slides are also available for download if you missed it. I was in a very popular webcast that we provided, which has been a tremendous amount of questions. We don't have the time here to get into all the details, but I would encourage you to go replay that broadcast for any further questions about mortgage loan originator compensation.
Great, thanks, Ken. Jason, another one for you. We sell most of our fixed-rate mortgages on the secondary market. Does that mean we will qualify for the, quote, skin-in-the-game regulations?
Great question. The reference to the skin-in-the-game regulations is in reference to the risk retention proposal that was issued earlier this year. That proposal is still in the review period. It does list some very specific guidelines for what would qualify as a qualified residential mortgage. So at this point, I'd hesitate to get into a lot of the details, but would refer you to any rules that are issued by that interagency body. And I believe at this point, it's expected sometime in the first half of 2012.
Okay, moving back to UDEP, Cecilia, can you expand a little bit on your comments on what you mean by smell test that appears on slide 23?
Okay, the smell test is basically like if you see something and it smells wrong or it makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up or there's just something there, it sort of even reaches back when there used to be predatory lending, you knew there was something wrong. It's basically just a phrase that's being used in the industry to say there's just something wrong with it and I need to dig a little further.
Okay, thanks, Cecilia. Another one on UDEP, but this one's directed to you, Ken. You mentioned that there are documents available that establish best practices within UDEP. Where are those housed? I think that's going to be similar to Jason's comment, but if you could please try and give that one another shot, that'd be great.
Well, just to repeat what I said earlier, the Bureau recently published its examination manual, and there's a detailed section of the manual that discusses unfair, deceptive, and abusive. It provides examples from prior enforcement actions and discusses these practices in detail, and that's what we're trying to encourage financial institutions to go to that. And one of the slides I provided, we gave the link to open that. And the nice thing about the supervision manual, it's bookmarked, so you can easily navigate to the different sections of the manual, and I would encourage you to review that. And in addition, as I said in my presentation, on our Outlook website, if you click on the main site, Consumer Compliance Resources, we have a section on the resources devoted to UDAP. There's FTC documents and other documents that help further explain what is the meaning of unfair or deceptive.
Great. Thanks, Ken. Cecilia, we have one here for you with regard to the change in the collection of the CRA and HUNDA data to use the updated census data. And there is some concern that perhaps third-party vendors won't be available until March or later, and what that means in terms of collecting your data and how the regulatory agencies would look at that.
Good, thank you. You know, there wouldn't be any violation with that because we wouldn't be citing any CRA or HMDA violation until it's reported in the following year. However, we would emphasize to continue to work with your third-party vendors so that you have a backup. So you don't have a backup of loan data that you'll need to geocode once it gets updated, and that's critical. And the other thing is, please remember that if you can't geocode this data, the bank itself cannot be doing its own self-assessments of their performance with this information. So that's where I really recognize and reach out to say, really reach those third-party vendors. We realize that there could be a hiccup, but enough people bringing it forward could also maybe move it a little quicker as the FFIEC is bringing it out in 2012.
Okay, so yeah, and we have one now for you on flood, and some folks want to know when the public comments are due for those proposed changes that you had mentioned.
Okay, and I'm sorry for not mentioning this during the presentation. The public comments were due 45 days after the flood proposed Q&As changed and when it hit the Federal Register. It was posted to the Federal Register on October 17, 2011, so the comment period ended early in December, so we'll have to wait and see what happens with those proposals with the FF or the interagency.
Okay, and we have time for just one more here. So, Jason, I'm going to ask you. There's some questions out there with regard to the rules that the Bureau is responsible for writing, and how does the fact that they do not have a confirmed director impact their ability to write rules and the potential effective dates of some of those?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question with regards to kind of the delays in the confirmation process. A lot of the rules specifically require action by the director. Most of the rule writing we're expecting to be delayed until a director is confirmed. So at this point, notwithstanding some of the prototype disclosures as well as some of the solicitations for input, the Bureau's rule writing may be limited until the director is confirmed.
Thanks, Jason. Okay, so that does conclude our time today. I want to thank Jason, Ken, and Cecilia for their presentations today. I think you were able to give us a good perspective on a wide range of issues. We hope you found the presentation useful. I want to apologize again once more for the technical difficulties that we had at the beginning of the presentation. And one last comment, as soon as the presentation ends and you exit the main menu, a short feedback form should appear on your screen. It might not show up if you have your pop-up blocker set. In that case, you can select the survey tab before exiting the main screen to access the feedback form. We would really appreciate it if you could take just a couple minutes to let us know what you liked about the presentations, any suggestions for improvement, and most importantly, possible topics for future calls as we start planning for events in 2012. Your feedback is incredibly helpful in this regard. Thanks again for joining us today, and that does conclude our call. Please look for additional announcements on future calls. Thank you.